tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2022, and this is episode 282, which is a conversation about scientific materialism and the origin of life problem. Today's guest is Dr. Melissa Kane Travis, who serves as an affiliate faculty at the Lee Strobel Center for Evangelism and Applied Apologetics at Colorado Christian University. Melissa is also the author of Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God. Melissa has written a feature article in the Christian Research Journal, and her article is called Facing the Abyss, Scientific Materialism and the Origin of Life Problem. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. As I was mentioning, this is another one of the articles in a series of three articles that Melissa has written for us on this subject. So this is the second article in a three-part series. And again, this article is called Facing the Abyss, Scientific Materialism and the Origin of Life Problem. And so you've written on something that I just mentioned in the title, the Scientific Materialist Manifesto. So could you describe for our listeners, if they missed our other podcast or haven't read any of the articles in this series, what do you mean by the Scientific Materialist Manifesto?
What I mean by this phrase, Scientific Materialist Manifesto, is a genre of books that are written by atheist scientists or atheist science popularizers that attempt to promote the materialist philosophy by arguing that science has already explained or has nearly explained all of the fundamental mysteries of existence, like the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness and rationality. And the main goal of these authors is to use what I'd call the alleged sufficiency of science to undermine any worldview that posits God or even anything like God as part of the explanation for these phenomena. And further, they attempt to explain away all the immaterial things that actually make human life worth living. And I talked about this in the first article of the series. So things like meaning and purpose and value, morality, free will, etc. And these books, these scientific materialist manifestos, they're often turned into documentary films or television series. Brian Greene's name, for example, is usually recognized even by people that don't have much of a science background because he's done these viral TED Talks, and then he has documentaries that are based upon his books that are exciting and accessible. And so his name is usually recognized. And he's one of these authors that writes the genre of books I'm referring to. So these works are meant to paint this comprehensive picture of reality, but they want to do it without supposing that mind rather than matter is the fundamental principle of existence.
So just as a follow-up to that question, I mean, why do you think that these scientists are getting into more, you know, like philosophical and theological topics? I mean, why are they really kind of addressing these bigger issues like the meaning of life right now? What do you think is causing some of these books to come out at this particular time?
Well, that's what's so fascinating to me, right? So they want to talk about science. They want to champion science. It's such a huge talking point right now, especially, for example, with those progressive lawn signs that you see people putting out in their yards that say, in this house, we believe blah, 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 blah. And one of the lines is that science is real, right? So there's this pervasive idea that has just come all that much more to the forefront during the years of the COVID pandemic, that science has the objective and best answers to all of human existence. But if you think about it, science really can't address the things that make our lives worth living, like the ones that I listed a moment ago, you know, meaning, value, purpose, so on and so forth. And these writers are recognizing that. It's not just about explaining how all the material things of the universe work, or even positing theories for how they came to be, but we need so much more than that to flourish as human beings. And so they're trying to argue that their scientific materialist worldview can even make sense of those things. And they use lots of smooth rhetoric to explain why they believe that to be so. But even just a minimally insightful reader can see through it and see that they're really not doing any such thing. They're not giving us satisfactory explanations for the big things that matter.
So in your article, you mention three singularities that defy naturalistic explanations. So what are they exactly?
The three singularities are the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of mind. In his book, The Everlasting Man, very, very famous book, The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton, Chesterton used the imagery of a bridge. And he said, these bridges are built over these massive abysses of the unthinkable, or what he called them. So each of these big mysteries, origin of life, origin of the universe, origin of mind, these are huge abysses of the unthinkable. And for Chesterton, God was very obviously an engineer of a bridge that crosses each one of these, going from nothing to something, from inanimate matter to life, and from biological automata to sentience and rationality. These three singularities each require an essential ingredient that materialism cannot supply. It's not that the materialist paradigm hasn't yet supplied the necessary building blocks for these bridges. It's that the type of building blocks that are needed transcend the material. And so that's why Chesterton called these the great abysses. And he recognized that naturalistic materialist explanations don't even begin to solve these kinds of problems.
So in this particular article of this series, you address the origin of life as the singularity you write about in this article. So what sort of problem does the origin of life present for scientific materialism?
Well, clearly the listeners all probably know that the origin of life problem is insanely complex. But if we boil it down to layman's terms, just the basics, this is essentially a problem of the origin of information. And for those listeners who don't remember much about high school biology, what I mean by that is the structure and function of living cells is dictated by information. And this is largely the digital coding that's contained in the double-stranded DNA molecule. So we have this informational code, this four-digit code that's transcribed from DNA into single-stranded RNA molecules. And those RNA molecules are what are then translated into these amino acid chains that fold into the functional proteins in our body. And as everyone is probably aware, proteins are the workhorses of all living cells. So in other words, what we have is this coding sequence in DNA that downstream leads to these complex geometrical structures that are our functional proteins. So we have specified code, a biological language that is in every conceivable way fundamental to life. So if we're going to explain the origin of life, the origin of the very first living cell, we have to have an account of where this specialized coding came from, where biological information came from.
So you zero in on the genetic coding of living organisms as, you know, quote, the great abyss. You talked about that a few minutes ago, that can't be crossed by, you know, fully naturalistic processes. So can you explain what you mean by this?
Sure. based upon all of our observational experience, all of our empirical investigation of the world, we know that language, which would include digital coding, always comes from an intelligent mind. So if the scientist who's committed to materialist explanations for all things, including the abyss of the origin of life, they face a major roadblock because information is not itself material. Okay, so they're trying to come up with this material scientific explanation for something that is not intrinsically material. And so their explanations ultimately fail to account for it. We can build reasonable theories about things like chemical evolution, about the origin of very, very simple prebiotic molecules that come about thanks to the laws of chemical attraction. But it's a whole different thing to go from that to making this big leap to molecules capable of self-replication. And self-replication is what's required for selection mechanisms to operate. And by that, I mean, if you don't have, let's use the word reproduction. If you don't have something that is reproducing, then you can't get a selection effect that's weeding out the less fit and favoring the more fit. You don't get like this survival of the fittest thing going on in order for there to be positive evolutionary change. So what you have to have is a self-replicating genetic molecule to even make a big stride towards getting the first living cell, but you have to have tons and tons and tons of genetic information to get molecular self-replication in the first place. And proponents of intelligent design argue that this is exactly where intelligent agency has to come into the conversation, though we can't with any certainty know the details of how intelligent agency was involved, whether it's sort of this initial orchestration type of thing or an intervention type of thing in natural history. But we can say merely that we have all this biological information that needs to be accounted for, and from that, we draw this inference to an intelligent designer of life.
We are running a brand new giveaway for our listeners, and this giveaway ends June 30th, 2022. And this giveaway is, of course, for a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal anywhere in the world. And in addition, if you live in the United States, if you win this giveaway, you will get these additional swag bonuses of four different books. The first one is called Doubts About Darwin. The second and third one are actual hardcover books of the best of the Christian Research Journal. One is called What is Truth? The other one is called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals? And just kind of classic apologetics articles from our archives. And then the final one is called Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World by Paul Gould. And of course, as you know, in the Postmodern Realities podcast, we do cover a bunch of cultural apologetics. So that will be a great equipping book. And so here's how you enter. In order to enter, you just go on to Apple Podcasts. I know it takes a moment to just sign in there, but you give us a written review. It can be really short, just one sentence, one or two sentences, just a few words about why you like to listen to this podcast. And that enters you in because we'll do a drawing from all of the names or handles that are on there. And anyone that's been entering from the beginning of this contest through June 30th will receive one entry, and we will spin the wheel and someone will win this prize. So please do go on there, because as you do so and you write us a review, it's a way in which you can help other people who have the similar interest of you in cultural apologetics and apologetics to find this podcast. Now, of course, we're always grateful for the other ways you help us, which is just get the word out there. Simply tell a friend about this podcast or share one of your your favorite episodes on your social media accounts or email it to a friend or however you want to get it out there. We just really appreciate your partnership with us. The other thing is, of course, we'd love for you to subscribe to our journal. We are continuing to try to grow our subscription base. And what you get for your subscription is all the print issues directly to your door, plus all the online exclusives that we have on our website that you hear about in these podcast episodes. So give us a subscription, would be great. Also as a gift to a friend if you already subscribe, or if a subscription is not in your budget right now, please, we would ask that you consider giving us a tip. I mean, $3 or $5, giving up one of your favorite coffees for the week at your favorite coffee shop and giving us a tip to help us bring you this content. So thank you. Well, in your article, you are addressing non-theist scientists. Brian Greene in particular, he's a mathematician and a physicist, and he teaches at Columbia University where he's a professor there. And then Sean Carroll, I have heard from before, and I'm not a real science nerd or anything, but he is very well-spoken. I mean, he can take things and put them at a very much of a lay level. And he is a physics professor at Caltech. And actually, interestingly, has even debated William Lane Craig before. So these guys speculate about a naturalistic scenario that they think and believe could have given rise to the first life form. So do their suggestions undermine the case for the intelligent design of life? And as I said, like normally you think of some physicists as not being well-spoken, but Sean Carroll, like I mentioned, he is well-spoken. And so it seems very believable to people to, accept what he is positing.
Right. And when I critique the kinds of arguments these guys are making, I'm doing that in a full spirit of charity. I think Brian Greene and Sean Carroll, for example, are highly intelligent, well-credentialed men of science who have a talent for breaking these things down and explaining them in an accessible way. And that's why their books and lectures and even their documentaries, or at least Brian Greene's documentaries, I don't know if Carroll has any or not, tend to attract a lot of people who have genuine interest in the sciences. But to answer the question, I really do not see in any way, shape, or form that these naturalistic scenarios that they suggest do anything to undermine the case for intelligent design in any ultimate sense. So in his book, Until the End of Time, Greene devotes this entire chapter to the origin of life problem. And he actually openly acknowledges the fact that the problem remains unsolved. And he says, here's a quote from one of the chapters, "While there has been impressive progress in decomposing life and matter more generally into its constituent parts, researchers still face the formidable task of laying out how life emerges when collections of these constituents are arranged in particular configurations." So in other words, how the highly specified sequences that constitute things like biological information even come about in the first place. And then once you have parts, how are things orchestrated into living cells and then living systems? Despite the problem, despite this very formidable problem for the origin of life, Greene is just convinced that, quote, "even without a complete understanding, we can turn to an explanatory framework, Darwinian evolution," and I love how he phrases this, "that will almost certainly be an integral part of the future narrative." So what he's doing here is he's sort of writing this promissory note on behalf of naturalism. He's like, okay, Darwinian evolution has already explained so much for us, so surely it is within that general methodological framework that we're going to eventually get a satisfactory answer for the origin of life. So he goes on to talk about how the origin of life problem will eventually be solved by theorizing some sort of selection mechanism, much like Darwinian natural selection, only this would be a selection mechanism that operates at a chemical level rather than at the biological level when living organisms reproduce and then populations go through change based on the principle of survival of of the fittest. And then Brian Greene goes on, he suggests that, well, on the primordial earth, there were probably certain molecules that were hardier than other molecules. And so they were more likely to survive in their environment. And then various chemical principles could lead to the formation of extra copies of these hardy molecules. But then all of a sudden, he starts glossing over the situation in terms of exactly how much sequential organization that would have to occur in order to get to truly self-replicating molecules, which is what we have to even get started on the path to life, not even to mention all the highly specialized structures that have to come together to constitute even a very primitive, basic living cell. And Green writes, once molecules acquire the capacity to replicate, chance errors and mutations will feed molecular Darwinism, driving chemical concoctions along the all-important vector of increased fitness. And then here's another of the gloss over sentences. He says, playing out over hundreds of millions of years, the process has the capacity to build the chemical architecture of life. Okay, that sentence is a huge, huge naturalistic assumption. He knows nothing of the sort, okay? He's just doing that naturalistic promissory note, just so story thing that we often see done in the Scientific Materialist Manifesto. So then he goes on and he says that based on the great power of this molecular Darwinism that he suggests, we can envision, that's the word he uses, we can envision how some molecules might acquire the capacity to store and transmit information. And then he says, acting out over hundreds of millions of years, these processes may have gradually sculpted the first life. So like I said, if you have a reader who's even a little bit insightful and can carefully read these sentences and note the kind of language he's using and ask hard questions about the kinds of declarations he's making, they're going to start seeing through this for what it is. So we have with Green and with Carroll and with lots of other scientific materialists, these imaginary scenarios that at the end of the day, never ever address the root of the problem. And the root of the problem being, where are we getting this immaterial phenomenon of biological information that is coded onto material chemicals?
So you just noted that these scientific materialists acknowledge that the origin of life is not solved now. But why do some of them still seem, you know, optimistic about the future of the origin of life research?
Well, I think the key phrase there is some of them, because not all of them hold out such optimism. There are plenty of scientific materialists that don't hold out much hope for origin of life research. And then they've come right out and made that admission. And I can't speak for all of those who are optimistic, but what I'll say is I strongly suspect they're just incredibly confident in their philosophical paradigm, in the materialist paradigm. And they really believe that an increase in our understanding of the prebiotic earth is somehow progress towards a solution to the origin of life problem. But all that really does, learning new things about the chemical composition of the early earth, all that really does is get us closer and closer to the edge of the abyss. It doesn't even begin to build the bridge. What we need in order to get started on the bridge is a great explanation for how all of these prebiotic chemicals could come together in a way that gives us the highly specified biological information necessary. But like I said, you hit a brick wall because information itself is not material.
So there are those who've said that, you know, intelligent design isn't an optional option for a rational solution to the origin of life problem because it commits this God of the Gaps mistake. So first of all, please explain for our listeners what the God of the Gaps view is and what do you think of this thesis that it's not an option?
The God of the Gaps mistake is when we look at the scientific information we have about a material phenomenon and we have big unanswered questions about things like, how does it work? Or how is it made? Or what's the history behind its development, for example? And so we look at it, and with this incomplete information about the phenomenon that we're studying, we say, oh, well, God must have done it. So one famous, or I guess I should say notorious example of the God of the Gaps mistake is when people did not know where thunder and lightning came from. They didn't know what caused it. And so they would say, oh, the gods are angry. And that rumbling and those flashes of light are them punishing us for whatever it is they're angry about. So this plugging God into this gap in knowledge. And very often intelligent design proponents get accused of doing this when they say that intelligence was necessary in the origin of certain things like the origin of the universe or the origin of life. I think that this very frequently, not in every case, but very frequently, the God of the Gaps accusation is misused against the proponents of intelligent design. So the ID proponent is pointing to a phenomenon in nature. In this case, we're pointing to the digital information contained in living organisms. And the ID person is making an inference to the best explanation for the phenomenon of biological information. They're not just saying, oh, we don't know, so let's just throw God into this gap here. As I mentioned before, in all of our experience, this level of specialized information always, always, always comes from an intelligent mind. And as I've said a couple of times already, information itself is not material. So it really lies outside the purview of scientific investigation. And even if, and this is a really, really big if, even if origin of life researchers mapped out a feasible chemical pathway to self-replicating genetic molecules, that still wouldn't do anything to explain why chemicals would ever organize in a biologically viable way. When it comes to information, the material medium is not the message. So in the case of the DNA molecule, for example, you have this chemical medium, but it's the sequence of the chemicals in the molecule that have this intrinsic message, and the message is not material. So to reiterate, the material medium itself is not the message. And so I think we can turn the tables here and we can say, well, the materialists are the ones making a gaps argument. It's a naturalism of the gaps mistake. And they're making that by assuming that an immaterial phenomenon, biological information, could ever be explained by material processes alone. So one example that my hero, Dr. John Lennox, is fond of giving is when you have printed sentences on a page, right? You've got paper and you've got ink, and you might be able to explain how the ink got onto the paper. You might be able to explain how the paper and ink were made. But using these chemical explanations, you cannot explain where the information conveyed through the medium came from. And so to say, oh, eventually we will have a naturalistic explanation for information is really what I think is just a perfect example of naturalism of the gaps.
I think it's really interesting. You mentioned in your article that Sean Carroll has written this quote, "No serious scientist working on the origin of life, even those who are personally religious, points to some particular process and says, Here is the step where we need to invoke the presence of a non-physical life force or some element of supernatural intervention. So I think that's really interesting when you're talking about this naturalism of the gap. So is this naturalism of the gaps that you're talking about, is that the legacy of Charles Darwin?
In some ways, it really is. So Darwin's goal was to figure out a fully naturalistic theory to explain the complexity and the diversification of all species of life. Even though he was, in 1859, when his Origin of Species was published, completely ignorant of biochemistry. So we can only speculate what his position would be if he were living today. But in any case, Darwinism, as this search for fully naturalistic explanations, has since Darwin's time taken on a life of its own. Now it's this this wholesale materialist philosophy of science that has to result to this naturalism of the gaps for these three big singularities, because if they don't resort to naturalism of the gaps, then they're allowing a divine foot in the door, as Richard Lewontin famously put it.
And it definitely seems from that Carroll quote that that is not even an option for him at all. So, you know, it's often said that Darwin dealt a death blow to design arguments. I mean, specifically, I just quoted Carroll's comment about it, based upon biology. So do you agree that even people who are scientists who are personally religious just need to reject a design argument altogether?
Oh, I completely disagree. So what Darwin did was he suggested a feasible mechanism for gradual change in biological populations. And then he went on to speculate that the process, natural selection acting on random variations, can be extrapolated out over long periods of time to explain massive changes, you know, groups of or species diversifying into new species over long periods of time, leading from a common ancestor of all living things to all of the complexity and diversity that we're able to observe today. Okay, so he suggested a feasible mechanism for the gradual change we observe, and then he extrapolated it out to a much larger scale. Some people like to use the words microevolution and macroevolution. So we can observe microevolution, but it's when you extrapolate it out that you can apply the word macroevolution. But all of that to say, even if Darwin was right about evolutionary history, okay, I'm just playing the hypothetical game here. Even if he was right, that doesn't do anything to undercut design arguments that are based on the origin of life or even evolutionary speciation. So what I mean is, when you describe a mechanism, even when you extrapolate it out and make very grandiose claims about what that mechanism is capable of doing, it doesn't rule out an engineer of the mechanism. Prominent biologists of Darwin's time argued this. So they were accepting his theory of evolution by natural selection, but they saw design implications in Darwin's theory. So, for example, Alfred Russel Wallace, he was the co-discoverer of the theory of natural selection, and he argued in multiple places that intelligent design pervades nature. And like I said, he was accepting of Darwin's theory. And then another great example would be Asa Gray. Asa Gray was a famous Harvard biologist. He was also a devout Christian and probably Darwin's biggest American supporter during Darwin's lifetime. But Gray didn't think Darwinism did anything at all to support a naturalistic worldview. And this was, funny enough, it was a great source of frustration for Darwin. He appreciated Gray's support over here in America, but he did not like that Gray saw design implications in nature. And in my article, I give this wonderful illustration that Asa Gray wrote in order to address this issue. He says, recall a woman of a past generation and show her a web of cloth. Ask her how it was made, and she'll say that the wool or cotton was carded, spun, and woven by hand. When you tell her it was not made by manual labor, that probably no hand has touched the materials throughout the process, it's possible that she might at first regard your statement as tantamount to the assertion that the cloth was made without design. If she did, she would not credit your statement. If you patiently explain to her the theory of carding machines, spinning jennies, and power looms, would her reception of your explanation weaken her conviction that the cloth was the result of design? It is certain that she would believe in design as firmly as before, and that this belief would be attended by a higher conception and reverent admiration of a wisdom, skill, and power greatly beyond anything she had previously conceived possible. So in other words, Gray is saying, look, the mechanism gives you an even stronger material reason to make an inference to intelligent agency. So to be clear to our listeners, I'm not in any way whatsoever arguing for an evolutionary history of life. I'm only going to great pains to emphasize the point that evolutionary theory, whether all of it is true or not, doesn't destroy design argumentation. And I love how John Lennox has put it. I have to wonder when he said this, if he was thinking about illustrations such as the one given by Asa Gray. Lennox says, the existence of mechanisms and laws is not an argument for the absence of an agent who set those laws and mechanisms in place. On the contrary, their very sophistication is evidence for the creator's genius.
So for our listeners that might want to dig a little bit deeper into this subject, what are some good resources for them if they want to read something that's accessible, like an accessible introduction to biochemistry and its relation to the origin of life?
For those who already have a little bit of scientific background knowledge, I would highly recommend Stephen Meyer's work. His work on this specific topic is absolutely excellent, and he has a trilogy of books: Signature in the Cell, Darwin's Doubt, and then Return of the God Hypothesis. And all three of those books deal with the problem of the origin of biological information in one way or another. So you get some repetition, but you also get some topical variety among the three books. And although there is some technical content in all three of those, I think Meyer does an outstanding job of making it as clear and understandable as possible. And I'd also like to encourage readers, you know, the way we grow our minds is to read books, some of which may go over our heads the first time around. And I first really came to appreciate that idea when I was learning from J.P. Moreland at Biola University. He said, we need to constantly be reading material that we don't fully understand, because that's the only way we're going to grow our minds. But for those who really need a super basic introduction, I devote a chapter of my book, Science in the Mind of the Maker, to the Origin of Life issue. I go into some of the mechanics of the biochemistry involved. And then there are two really great short video series that I would recommend. One's just a super fun animated series, and I would even use this with grade school kids. And the title of the series is Long Story Short. And then there's another series called Secrets of the Cell with Michael Behe. And both of those short video series can be found on the Discovery Science YouTube channel, and they're totally free. So those would be my recommendations.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have a couple of rapid fire questions for Melissa. So Melissa, today, what is the best sandwich?
Oh, the best sandwich, Monte Cristo.
And when you're flying on a plane, do you like a window seat or an aisle seat?
Window.
And besides the big things, of course, like the Bible and your family, what are two things you cannot live without?
Oh, two things I cannot live without. I cannot live without fantasy literature, and I cannot live without great coffee.
Well, thanks, Melissa, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Oh, you're so welcome. This was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to episode 282 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Dr. Melissa Kane Travis. She has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal called Facing the Abyss, Scientific Materialism, and the Origin of Life Problem. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Now, normally articles from our print issues are only available to our subscribers, but this is an article we want to make free for everyone so you can see the kind of content that you receive when you subscribe to our journal.